Hi, everybody. I'm Esther Wien. And I think this class was billed as the power of negative thinking, or defining Kedusha, which is holiness. Now, this subject applies and is relevant at all times, but specifically now, right before Pesach, it's a good time to think about the notion of holiness, because for the Pesach was specifically the redemption from Egypt, the beginning of the Jewish people, our birth of the nation, was simply to free us up from all other constraints so that we can become the people that are considered Or Lagoyim, a light unto the nation. That is what the Torah calls us, and that's how we see ourselves. We see ourselves as shedding light because we have some insight and some truth that we hope we can share with everyone else. And one of the aspirations of the Jewish nation as a nation and as each person individually is to be, as God asks of us before giving the Torah, which was the purpose of taking us out of Egypt, God asks us if we will be a goy kadosh, a holy nation. Kadosh is holy. Now the truth is that the word holy doesn't mean very much. I mean, what is holy? Swiss cheese is holy. What do we mean when we say holy? And so we're not going to use the word holy. We're going to use the word kadosh. We have to be a nation that is kadosh. But when we start thinking about what kadosh is, we begin to get a little uncomfortable because the Hebrew definition for kadosh is mufrash, separated. Separated. Separated from what? Separated from thought, speech, and action. In other words, separated from the wrong thoughts, thoughts we shouldn't think. Separated from prohibited actions, actions we should not take. And separated from not only thought, but also speech, words we don't say, things we are not allowed to say. Now, in America today, in the age of personal freedom and autonomy, there are some ideas that make us feel warm and cozy when we hear about them, and some words and concepts that make us immediately resistant. Now some words that perhaps make us feel good, good words or good ideas would be something like a word like dignity or velvet, apple pie. These make us feel good. We respond. There's a certain warmth and openness. But then there's certain words we don't want to go near. Words such as disqualified or forbidden, prohibited. We don't like words like that. Words like forbidden and prohibited make us feel resistant. Who says? Morality rests with my opinions and my perspectives. Who says forbidden? It's an age of trying everything, personal freedom. And yet when we speak about holiness, as the Jewish nation is a holy or kadosh nation and an individual is asked to be kadosh, we are speaking about the forbidden, the negative, what we do not do, what we do not think, what we do not say. And everybody who knows a little bit about Judaism knows that there are a lot of restrictions and prohibitions and things are not permitted. But we don't like to think about that because that's not how we function normally. It's uncomfortable, and yet it's a large part of Judaism. It's a freedom that the story of Pesach reminds, recalls for us a freedom, not a freedom from all restraints and constraints, but a freedom that binds us to a way of life, to become Jews, to live a Jewish life, which and then in turn restricts our freedom to a great degree, no question about it. The secret of Pesach is just that we went from being slaves to a person to being slaves to God, where there's a lot of restriction, there's a lot of demand, there's a lot of prohibitions, and that's what we're here to talk about, because we call that in Hebrew kadosh. Kadosh, as we said, means mufrash, separated from. In the portion of the Torah where God himself says to the Jewish people, be kadosh because I am kadosh, the explanation is be separated for I am separated. Do not indulge in all kinds of various thoughts and speeches and actions, things that we call forbidden, sin, because I, God, am separated. And now we have to go deep, try to understand philosophically what it means, what kadosh means and what it means that God is separated. So let's start like this. Thinking in the negative. Thinking about what we don't do. We'll take some questions after. Unless it's basic to the...
Well, maybe.
A definition or something.
Well, just about kadosh. I wonder if you could also say it refers to being separate from the other nations.
Absolutely. Goy Kadosh is separate from the other nations. Separate for, and now we, what we're defining tonight is separate for what? What is the, what is the framework of separate? Very, very true. Let's think about the negative, what we don't do or say or think. But before we get into those type of areas, let's just think of some ideas that will bring into focus the concept of the importance of what's not there. I'm thirsty. So I say, would you do me a favor, bring me some water, and bring me a glass. So a nice volunteer brings me a block of glass. What went wrong? Did I want a block of glass? So what did I want when I said, bring me a glass?
A glass of water.
True, but I said I want glass. So what type of, define the glass. Give me the parameters of the glass, the kind of glass I want.
With water in it?
You wanted a hollow cylinder for the one end.
Say it again?
You wanted a glass shape like these things here.
Okay, take it further. What makes this into a glass, let's say, and makes it useful? What I want is emptiness surrounded by a little glass, no? Because it's the emptiness that I'm making use of. Look, the glass manufacturer, they understand that there's all kinds of ways to create, to hold emptiness. There's long, thin emptinesses and short, wide emptinesses for wine and taller, you know, stouter emptinesses, either way, however, whatever you want to do. There's all kinds of ways to shape the glass around the emptiness, but the essential part is not where there is glass, where there is not glass, no? But that's invisible, right? No one thinks of that except the one who makes the glass. What about music? If you had 10 instruments and each wanted the sound go, everyone played an unbroken tone. No highs, no lows, and no pauses, no silences. Just an unbroken tone. You call that music? Music is the tone and the sound and the pause. The longer tone, the shorter pause. The shorter tone, the longer pause. You begin to develop some type of a melody. It's not just when there is music. The invisible part, when there is not music, is equally critical, where there is no sound. It's not only about what we do, it's when we restrain, we refuse to do, we hold back that creates the total product. It's like that in every aspect of life. Here's another example, in art. Negative space, right? Who's familiar with negative space? So you can explain that simply put, you might say that if the whole canvas had equal amount of intense coloration, there could be no, perhaps, focal point in a certain type of art, right? So you want to create negative space somehow or another so that the eye goes to a direct place. It's what isn't there that helps, that creates the totality. Here are more examples. Let's talk about psychological examples, ideas in human interaction. So marriage. Now, just because I'm a woman, I'll make the man the bad guy. So a woman says, I don't know, a woman is divorcing her husband, and the man says, I just don't know why she's so upset at me. I am a terrific husband. I communicate with her. I give her all the time she needs. Whenever she wants to talk, I'm there. I support her financially. Everything she wants. I enjoy the same forms of entertainment that she enjoys. We enjoy spending time together. I'm a good friend to her. I'm loyal. I'm responsible. Whatever she wants, I do for her. Why is she so upset at me? Except he neglects to mention one little small technical detail. He also conducts himself this way with another woman. In other words, marriage, okay, marriage is not just about who you're married to, right? It's about who you are not married to, period. Too familiar one. Look, we make a bracha. under the chuppah, it's almost like a business contract. But it states this point. It says, blessed are you, Hashem, who has forbidden to me all others and permitted to me this one. Now, do you think we all get together and dance like Mr. Goyim at a wedding because we're so happy that two people are finally joining together and everybody knows why? That's normal. That's natural for two people to come together. That's not what we're celebrating. That's not anything special or unusual. What we're celebrating is the exclusivity of this couple, that now they recognize that they are mufrash, separated from everybody else. That's already something different. They are now mufrash, separated from everyone else. No one else is available. So to establish a strong marriage, it's not just imperative to have in mind who I'm married to and my obligations to them, but to know at all times, by the way, no matter what's going on in the marriage, no matter if the spouse got a little fat and a little ugly and isn't so charming anymore, it doesn't matter. As long as I'm married, I am not married to anyone else, period. End of story, no matter what the rationales are. Then the marriage is solid. That's the basis of a true marriage. It's not just what we do. It's what we refuse to do. The red lines we do not cross. But we begin to understand that if we don't set up red lines for ourselves, which are really given to us by God himself in the Torah, telling us the red lines we don't cross, we descend into chaos. You have no music when all the instruments are playing, or the, you know, one unbroken tones, and you have no useful entity here when it's full of glass. What if a scientist walked into a chemistry lab? And this is an allegory. People have argued this in terms of religion. And they say, you know, we have so much, us without the constraints of law and all the prohibitions and everything that's so forbidden, we have so much freedom because all things are open to us. We have endless options. And so we have to choose from, the whole world is at our fingertips to choose from. But you people, you're so constrained and you're so restricted, you could barely choose anything. You can barely choose anything. Everything's already set out for you, yes or no. You don't really have to exercise any free choice. Your whole choice is limited. It's like a chemist walking into a lab. So you have the one who knows nothing about chemistry, and there's 500 different chemicals all over the, you know, walls, and he says, thank God, I know nothing. I'm free to mix any chemicals in any proportions and do anything with them. I'm free. I'm not constrained by knowledge. So what happens? Usually destructive, and often nothing happens, and if anything happens, it's generally destructive. It's random, you know, chaos, nothing. But a person who is armed with knowledge and knows the properties of every chemical, knows exactly how much to combine with how much, and knows where to withhold. And only by carefully experimenting and restraint, and only using a certain amount of this chemical and a certain amount of that one, can they begin to discover, to learn, to find something. And then eventually to make a great contribution. Can we take questions at the end?
Yeah.
Or is it important for now?
Well, if you're simply told, you don't know. You're just told.
So wait, we'll get to that. Because everybody's meant to learn on their own. Everybody, you know. We'll talk. In any case, we're explaining the idea that the concept of prohibited or forbidden, well, we call it mufrash, knowing what to withhold, knowing what not to use, knowing, again, what not to think, what not to say, and what not to do. Now let's talk about what not to think. So, somebody wrongs us, really hurts us, and maybe even harms us financially or our reputation. In a real serious way, we are harmed. Maybe not forever, but it's important now. Now we have a few options. We can allow ourselves to be consumed with rage and go on a whole chaos of revenge, destroying mostly ourselves in the process, being consumed with anger, using up our money, using up all of our emotional, psychic energy to just get back at this person. Or we can take the Torah's advice. The Torah says, "Have you done es kol ha'adam l'kafos? Judge a person favorably." Now, the Torah is not written for fools, and it doesn't mean be an idiot and say, "Oh, we didn't do anything wrong." When the Torah says judge a person favorably, they're talking about judging the whole person. Have they done it? Kol ha'adam, judge the entire person. Which means look at the whole picture. See, you say to yourself, he did a terrible thing. Oh, shit. Terrible thing. But then you say to yourself, maybe if I had their pressures and their problems and their demons and their head and all the things playing on them, maybe I wouldn't have acted any differently. Maybe. And so you know what? He did a terrible thing, and I have a right to get back my money or whatever, however I was harmed, to be compensated, absolutely. But then drop it, because I don't know if I would have done anything else. And maybe, you know what? Maybe if I would have done something terrible to a different person, maybe that person would have been very generous and let it go. Maybe. So maybe I could be generous and just drop it and let it go. So we have a choice. If we adopt that way of thinking, in other words, refusing to think all the negative thoughts of anger and revenge and the frustration and the self-righteousness, etc., indignation, everything it is, if we refuse to go there, we save ourselves. We move on. We live more constructive lives. It's a choice. What we don't think is critical. Now, the Torah tells us certain things that we should not think. We should not think the worst of another person under any circumstances. There has to be a redeeming factor to a person. In fact, when there was a time of the Great Court and there was capital punishment, which was a very rare and unusual thing, once in 7 years they actually convicted someone to death, you know, to a death sentence, very rare, the law was that if there was a unanimous decision that the criminal or that the person was guilty, you went free. Because there has to be someone who can find the redeeming factor. It can't be that everyone's against this person. Then something's not right. So what you have here is guidelines in the Torah of how not to think, and they save our life, our health. What about what not to say? Now, as the emptiness in the glass and the silence and the music, you never know what a person isn't thinking. It's invisible. And you don't know what a person isn't saying. So a person has an opportunity to really cut into someone because they're being praised for their benevolence and generosity, and I know how corrupt they are and how self-serving they are. And I can do them in right now. I could pop the whole balloon. And I don't speak. For a simple example, my parent, my mother, is harassing me, and I don't answer back. I just don't. Nobody knows what we didn't say. Kedusha being separated. What we do not say is invisible to everyone besides ourselves and God. And what we don't think is invisible, and therefore nobody can judge how righteous a person is, because righteousness does not lie necessarily in how much charity a person gives and what they do all the time. It lies equally, or perhaps even more so, in what they don't do, in the lines they don't cross, the thoughts they don't think, and the words they don't say, and the actions they don't, will not take. This is where righteousness lies. Now, God himself says to the Jewish people, Kadoshim to you, you be Kadosh, because I am Kadosh. I am Kadosh. Now, what does that mean? God is not involved in what? Thought, speech, action. What do we mean when we say God is mufrash, separated? Here we get very philosophical. Well, God being separated, first and foremost, must mean that God is separated from what? From the physical world. God is not in this table, not in matter. You can't contain God in matter. Judaism doesn't believe God is contained in matter. He's not in the bottle of Coke. So what does that mean? That means that God is everywhere, but not in the Coke and not in the... In other words, not in matter? Well, what about space? Space is created like matter is created. So God is not in space and not in matter, so where is God? Outside of space, well, what is it? Where is God and where is God not? Where is God mufrash? So the best example we can give, but it's not a perfect example, because we say about Hashem that there is no allegory, there is nothing to compare him to. We don't have something to really compare God to. So in a limited way, this works. think about this phrase from the Gemara. The Talmud says, God is mekomo shel olam. He is the place of this world, but ein ha'olam mekomo. But this world is not his place. So what does that mean? He is the place in which this whole universe exists, but this universe is not God's place. So the allegory could be used, that we could use, is the allegory of the fetus in the mother's womb. Now the fetus is being carried by the mother, being kept warm, transported place to place, deriving all the nutrients from the mother, hearing muffled sounds of the mother's voice or conversation, heart. So it's true to say that the mother is the place that the fetus exists within, right? But the fetus does not contain the mother, yes or no? You see? The fetus might look like the mother, might live out the mother's dreams, might be animated on a moment-by-moment basis by the mother, but the fetus doesn't contain the mother. But the mother is the place of the fetus. So now we think about Hashem. Hashem says, I am the makom, the place that this whole universe exists within, but this universe does not contain me. I animate it, and I bring it to life, and I make it go every second and millisecond. But nothing physical contains God at the same time. So God is removed. He is mufrash from the physical world. Now we say that often in prayer. I hope you know if you've been to shul, especially on the holidays, there's a place where we stand up in the Amida, the silent prayer, and everyone goes, Kadosh, 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 which means separated, separated, separated is Hashem. That's what we're just talking about. But the second half of the phrase is, Malo kol ha'aretz kavodo. The whole world is filled with his glory. In other words, he envelops the world, but is not enveloped by the world. He is mufrash, separated. Now, just as Hashem, God, is involved, brings the world into existence and animates it on a moment-by-moment basis, but is not contained by the world, cannot be controlled by this world, so too there's an element to our kedusha, our separation, which is very similar to that aspect and understanding of God. We've spoken about separation from things completely, what we don't think, what we don't say, what we don't do. That's called kedusha, separation from sin, from forbidden. Why are things forbidden? Because the whole person is made up of not only where they go, but where they don't go. As we said, that creates the total person. So the Torah lays out for us. But even in the areas where we are permitted to indulge, where we are permitted to be involved, our sages and our teachers have explained that even in those areas we conduct ourselves as God conducts himself. We are involved, but we are not contained by it. We give it life, but it doesn't control us. So even in the areas of life that we are not prohibited from involving ourselves, such as eating, marriage, relations between man and woman, any type, that type of emotional expression, business, making money, setting up any kind of life, children, whatever it is, any human endeavor, we are involved, but we are not contained by, and in this way we are God-like. We're always above and slightly removed, imposing on ourselves red lines. So, we're taught in the Talmud, when educating children, look angry, but it is a sin. It is forbidden. It is absolutely considered a disgrace to the honor of God to be angry. It is forbidden to ever become angry, arrogant. Anger is a sign of great arrogance. Who are they to do this against me? And anger is forbidden, but the person is not forbidden from behaving as if they're angry for the purpose of education. So when a person eats, we eat, but we don't necessarily elevate eating to an art form so that it controls us and contains and takes over our whole life. As you know, the famous idea, you eat to live and you don't live to eat. And I remember my grandfather was a great, great righteous man, a famous rabbi in America, author of many books. His name was Rabbi Shimon Schwab. And he used to ask us after we would eat together on Shabbos, we would have the Shabbos meal, and he would say, so, we just completed what is called in Hebrew the Seudat Mitzvah, the feast which is a mitzvah. He said, so what did you enjoy? The Seuda, the feast, or the mitzvah? Which part was, and it was bringing you, bringing out your energy? Which were you focused on? In other words, although we involve ourselves in life, we also always maintain a control and a certain prisha, a certain separation, because we are in control, not our emotions, not our biological needs, not our momentary lust. Our mind is in control. The neshama, the soul, sits in the mind, not in the brain matter necessarily, but in what we call the mind. That is the seat of the soul. And that's what connects us to God. That is what reminds us of what we really are after in this world. And so we are mufrash. We always maintain a certain understanding of the value of what we don't do, the negative. Because a person is a totality. And here's another example. Two more things I want to just mention, then we'll have a discussion. I'll have to take questions. Shabbos and modesty. Shabbos, if anyone has kept Shabbos or had this enjoyment of being in a Shabbos or true Shabbos atmosphere, you know it's a day unlike any other day. People speak differently, they dress differently, they feel different. It's a day where we sit around and we enjoy the meal and we go to shul and we learn. It's just a whole, we just remove ourselves. It is a day that is kadosh, separated from the time. It is a little bubble in time. But you know, Shabbos, halachically, if you think about the law, Shabbos is not built off any positive commandments. There is only one mitzvah of what we have to do on Shabbos, what we must do from the Torah on Shabbos, and that is to make Kiddush, the blessing on the wine. And what Kiddush, the same word Kadosh, it initiates all of the prohibitions which make up Shabbos. You might notice, you might have learned, that Shabbos is a day built, constructed off enormous amount of prohibitions. The whole halachic basis of Shabbos is all the forbidden forms of labor, everything we can't do. There's 39 categories, and just categories, and if you add their laws, I don't even want to tell you how many there are. There are so many things that we do not do on Shabbos. Basically, they break down into three areas: the pursuit of food, pursuit of clothing, and the pursuit of shelter. Three basic categories. We do not do things that bring us into those enterprises working for our survival in any way, food, clothing, or shelter. In fact, we prepare it all before Shabbos, so that on Shabbos we do not have to concentrate on those things at all. We are freed from our basic survival needs, and we can concentrate on our spiritual side, on our neshama, on our souls. But Shabbos is a completely unique day, not because of the things we do, not because of the meal we eat and the nice clothes we wear. If you didn't have a good meal and you didn't have nice clothes, it's still Shabbos. Shabbos is unique because of what we are not doing. Because we're not doing anything necessarily that is in the pursuit of our physical survival. Even the eating on Shabbos is a whole different energy, a whole different nature. It's tanug, it's pleasure versus needing to survive. And modesty. Which applies to men and women, but of course, the rules are stricter with women. Now, what is modesty? Again, very unpopular. So everybody knows that we have a body, we have a soul. Well, people hopefully know this. And there's no question that a person's body does contribute to their personality and their sense of self. But there's no question that the soul, which is the individuality of the person, contributes a lot more to what makes up them as an individual person than their body. Look, if you took a picture of 1,000 men, okay, 1,000 white men, okay, or 1,000 black men, all undressed, cut all the heads off all the pictures, it's going to be hard to find yourself. Okay, a little taller, you have about a 12-inch range, 5 feet to 6 feet, a little this way or this way, a little more hair, less hair. There's not that much variety. It's going to be hard to find yourself in that picture. Okay, you have an unusual birthmark, but in general. But if you had 1,000 heads, faces, you'd find yourself in an instant, because your body is just not that different than everybody else's. but your faith is. Now we know that the if there's that we know that the faith is unique, and the Torah tells us and the Gemara tells us that as each person's faith is individualized, so each person's soul is individual. God went through the trouble of creating millions, billions of variations on a theme, because each neshama is individual. And what we really want to express to other people, what we really want other people to know us for, is our individuality, our thoughts, our sensitivities, our understanding of the world, how we see things, what matters to us, how we want to better things, the things that make an impression on us, the sensitivities we have. We really want people to relate to us for our soul, not for our body. Our bodies erode as we speak. They're not getting better, they're getting worse. All right? But how does anybody relate to your soul? It's invisible. That's the problem. Like everything, it's invisible. So if there's any part of your body that a glimmer of the soul shines through, it would be your face. The Hebrew word for faith, panim, is the same word as pnim, the inside. The eyes are the mirror to the soul. Chachmat adam ta'ir panat, the wisdom of a person illuminates their faith. The faith is the element of the person that allows a glimmer of the neshama, the soul, to shine through. And so the object of modesty, and it's for men too, but it's more for women, because women, we'll talk about women in a minute. The object of modesty is not that you must, as you might have learned about, you have to cover this and you have to cover that and you can't show this and you can't show that because it's forbidden to show this and it's forbidden to show that. It's the emptiness in the glass. We cover the body as a means of revealing the face. In other words, if we distract attention from what is not unique about us, then that automatically brings attention to the part that truly is unique and eternal and the part that gets better with age and not worse with age. The part that does not erode. The part that lives on. And so what we cover is all about what we want to show. What isn't there, where we hold back, brings out and brings into focus something much more precious. This is the secret of modesty. It's like you have a magnificent gem, you know, a 20-carat diamond, and you want to show it. You don't pick a complicated fabric with 1,000 colors. You pick a simple black velvet. You put the diamond on the black velvet in order to make it easy for the eye to go straight to what you want the eye to go to and not get distracted along the way. And that's why women cover a little bit more than men, because it's easier to get distracted, it seems, and not to focus on the neshama. Now remember, in art there are many forms of art, and we'll talk about the artist, the painter, and we'll talk about the sculptor. The painter creates his masterpiece or her masterpiece by a brushstroke, and another brushstroke, and a 10th brushstroke, and 100 brushstrokes, and 1,000 brushstrokes. And that's analogous to all the things we do. The things, the mitzvot, the good things, the positive things, the constructive things we do. Endless brushstrokes. And eventually, a magnificent thing can emerge. But the sculptor creates a three-dimensional image by starting with a block, right, and chipping, removing. This doesn't belong, and this doesn't belong, and this has to go, and this I don't want, and this I don't want. Chip, 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 and what remains is something of great beauty and something three-dimensional. What we do, the mitzvot and everything we are involved in, that is the brushstroke. What we do not do, where we hold back, where we are aware of the benefits of restraint in completing the person, that is analogous to what the sculptor is doing. Both create an image, but you might say that the image created by removing, there's more dimension to it. The hard part about all of this is this is the essence of holiness, of kedusha, of righteousness, of saintliness, and nobody can see it. It is all invisible. Maybe when you're 70, some astute person will say, you know, in all my years, I've never heard them slander another person. maybe in all my years I've noticed they've never had a temper tantrum. You know, they've always controlled their temper. It's not visible. This is the thing. And yet it is the most godlike aspect of our humanity. And it's private. We live in a time where you demonstrate, you show, you let everyone know what you have. It's not about that. It's about a very private avoda, service of a person to their soul, knowing that they are built by not just what everyone sees and everything they do and all the wonderful things they do, but they are very much defined by the lines they don't cross. And when the Jewish people came out of Egypt and were founded as a nation and brought to the Mount Sinai, God offered them this opportunity. Do you want to be a separate nation? And we have been, unfortunately, never well accepted and held separate. And nobody really wants us. This is true. But that doesn't mean anything. The fact that a tiny piece of desert with no oil and no natural resources is the most contested piece of real estate in the history of the world just indicates something's going on there and everybody wants a piece of it. Something's there. No one would bother with that. There's something huge going on. And we're at the core of it. It's not just as a nation that we focus on the separation, but as individuals on the separation. But the separation does not mean we are aloof, or we are elitist, or we care nothing for everybody else. The separation is a model for all humanity, and humanity has learned from us. The world has learned from us many wonderful things. And there's the Torah that taught, and the Ten Commandments that taught some basic red lines that we don't cross, and the world has learned from them. We are proud of what the world has learned from us. This whole country, America, originally was founded on Judaic principles. John Adams is one of the greatest Jew lovers ever. In fact, John Adams has a great-great-grandson who converted to Judaism, is very, very religious, and is learning full-time in yeshiva in Lakewood, New Jersey. And he wrote, you might have read, he wrote extensively. He loved the biblical model of society and the Jewish model. And he learned much from the Jewish way of setting up life and the rule of law, which is our innovation. The concept of men are created equal, and even the king is equal under the law. And the idea that we do not believe eventually it evolved, his son John Quincy Adams, the hatred for slavery, Judaic values. We contributed this. We contributed the basic decent values and many of the decent values that form this society that we live in. And part of the values are based on not just what we do, but what we do not do. It's integral. And so we should think about that and never be shy or embarrassed to say, I don't do that. No, thank you. I don't go there. No, thank you. I don't eat that. Nothing to be embarrassed about. It's a world of freedom. Everyone can do whatever they want, a world of tolerance. We should be proud and strong to know that we're free to impose upon ourselves proper guidelines and restraints, like any professional, like any expert in any field knows that they must impose restraints in order to be successful. And so I wish all of us great luck in integrating these ideas. And the way to know more about this is to learn, just to learn what is it the Torah wants, what are the mitzvot, what do we do, how do the Jews live. And by the way, nothing to do with my class, but I love this book, and I think it's particularly appropriate for college students. It's written just for this time and, you know, and a lot of what you're learning if you're learning philosophy. God is Proof Enough by Walter Wurzberger, if anyone wants to look at it. It's a very interesting book. In any case, we'll end here. Who has some questions or comments? You can formulate them for a moment.
I think, be careful saying that our country was based on Jewish morals, especially if you're saying it's what you do not do, because the country was founded on a lot of massacres.
Absolutely. But I agree with you. This country is not perfect, but let's think about it. For 1 second, I agree. Well, it's a horrible thing. You know, it's very nice. You kill out all the Indians, and then when you have full control of the land, you say, we believe that all humans are created equal. But listen, I would just say this. This society is not perfect, okay? And the best we can hope for is not perfection, but a society that's moving forward towards something better, that sees that it can no longer countenance certain evils and wrongs that it allowed. In other words, it was a great evil, and certainly, forget about killing the Indians, the slave trade that, you know, that flourished in this country. But this country fought a war and abolished it. And other countries, till this day, did not abolish it. There are still, slavery is alive and well in many countries. So it's not perfection, but at least it's a sense that certain things will make us, what will destroy us, are unacceptable anymore. They cannot stand, and move forward. You know, sometimes progress is slow. Sometimes progress. You know what's a beautiful speech? I don't know if you saw Amistad. Did you see Amistad?
Mm-hmm.
That John Quincy Adams in The Slave Trade. You know, the founding fathers who said all men are created equal had slaves. Everyone knows that. You know, they knew it was wrong, or they couldn't get rid of them. It was an economic situation. It was, you know, wishy-washy. But time passed, and they stood up, a few of them, and eventually, you know, Lincoln and everything, and they got rid of it. So you have to judge things not by absolute amounts of perfection, but a movement forward towards something better. Now, when I say this country was based on biblical values, let me clarify that for a moment. First of all, they did envision themselves as creating the new Israel. They did. You know, some of the symbols of Harvard, even is it here also that they have the Urim V'Thummim and all of that. There were some very biblical symbols, but more than they saw themselves as creating a city on a hill, as they called it, and then they were the new Israel, and they were crossing the sea away from the oppression. They really saw the same thing going on. But you know what's interesting? You take a not-religious person today, secular person, a Jew or a non-Jew, and you say to them, just for fun, do you think you can be religious? Do you think you can be a good person if you're not religious? So they'll say, of course I could be a good person if I'm not religious. So you bait them and you say, no, I don't believe you can be a good person if you're not religious. So they say, of course, I am a good person. So you list me, okay, tell me what you do that you're a good person. Give me the list. You're a good person, what do you do that makes you good? Tell me.
Volunteer with charity.
You give charity, good, next.
We're going to end up with the Ten Commandments.
Correct.
Time, right?
Exactly. I don't kill, I don't steal, I don't commit adultery, I honor my parents, I give charity, I respect the environment, etc., right? Tell me something that is not directly derived from the biblical codes. Now, if you were in some places, some more primitive places, places that have not been affected by the Judaic system, and that's a large part of the world has been affected by us, obviously. But there are still places, dark places, primitive places, and Margaret Mead herself. I just read this in commentary about 8 months ago. You know the magazine Commentary? Did you read it at all? So these people, I forgot their names, they were into rights and protecting, you know, primitive peoples, native peoples. So they went to Margaret Mead at the time, and was in the Museum of Natural History. She spent her whole life there as an anthropologist with the primitive peoples, and they asked her to help get on board there to protect the primitive natives, you know, with the aborigines, I don't know who. And she said, she got angry, and she said, primitive peoples, they fight, they kill each other all day, they have contributed nothing to society, they're ridden with diseases, they have no education, there's nothing to glorify. In other words, this is Margaret Mead. Now, in other words, there are still places untouched by biblical values, which we take so for granted that we think they're just American values, okay? That if you ask them if they're good and they wanted to prove that they were good, they would not give you the list we just gave. I don't kill, I don't steal, I don't commit adultery, I honor my, you know, I take care of the poor. They don't give you that list. They'll give you this list. I don't heal the sick and I don't feed the poor because it's God's will that they should be sick and poor. Of course there are. There just was in the New York Times about a year ago a whole magazine section on the caste system in India, and these people are left alone and nobody will care for them because the gods, they're fatalists, they have a caste system, the gods made them.
A lot of them are Brahmin and they choose to be that way because they think that the physical body is not something that they want to be in.
True, but there is still a whole level of society that is completely abandoned and rejected because they're considered rejected by
their... And we still have reservations.
All I'm saying is there are societies that do not share the American list And they will say to you, what do you mean I don't kill it? These are not good ways. We take it for granted as so-called good values in America. We think they're American values. They are very Jewish values. That's all. And the world has been very affected by us. They have learned a lot from us. And that's a wonderful thing. Yeah.
For the sake of being the devil's advocate, is it not possible to say that these are very logical and straightforward things that would promote general order and that, you know,
yes, absolutely.
It's possible that many cultures have
except,
come to the same conclusion?
Yes, except one problem. It is possible that many cultures have come to the same conclusion. True. Absolutely. But even today, do not kill. Do not steal and do not commit adultery. Even in cultures that forbid those things, are they rampant? What about, is it really true that all cultures would have come to these same conclusions? Think about it.
Well, no,
but that's a subject of debate. But I do think that, and it seems to be the case, and this is an opinion thing, and somebody tried to write a book recently that even democracy was based on a biblical view, and others rejected that. This is not the main point. I do believe that many biblical values find their way into the way we think here in America, and it's a positive thing. I don't think it's perfection. I don't think things are distorted. It's not really about that. I don't want to really get off on that tangent now. I hope that the main message that I was trying to deliver was that one of the Jewish goals and ideals is to bring a person into focus with not just what we are involved in, but to think about that aspect of our humanity, which is where we restrain, and how that type of restraint in many areas really builds us as a human being. This is really what I hope to leave you with. And the other thing is a matter of difference of opinion, not that relevant, and certainly not Torah. You like it, you don't like it, you agree, you don't agree, but what is the main part of my speech was a Torah concept.
I can think of plenty of counterexamples to that too, like the Confucian system, or whoever was in charge to find what was right and wrong, or like the lots of cultures that didn't come to the conclusion of the Ten Commandments on their own. So, to play devil's advocate against myself.
Any other questions or comments? Have a wonderful Pesach, everybody.